Good evening and Sunday. Our program is Beeline, Alaska's only weekday evening conversation show, presented Monday through Friday at this time on KFRB Radio as a production of the Broadcast Center. And now for live spontaneous conversation until 8 o'clock, here's your host, Larry Carpenter.
Thank you very much, honey. Number 1008, Tuesday, December 18th, 1973. We're privileged to have with us this evening Alaska's former senator and territorial governor, Ernest Greening. Welcome to our show.
Nice to be here, Larry.
You called Secretary Morton's setting aside of about a quarter of the landmass of Alaska today as a land grab. Could you comment on that?
I think this is one of the most outrageous things that's happened to Alaska. I think it is a staggering blow to the future of Alaska. And I think the people of Alaska have got to do everything to fight it and to prevent its happening. Now, let me briefly illustrate what happened. In the Native Claims Act, an amendment was introduced which is completely irrelevant. It had nothing whatever to do with native claims, put in there by and the pressure of certain conservationist groups, that provided that the Secretary of the Interior could set aside not to exceed 80 million acres for national parks, wildlife refuges, wild rivers, and so forth. And Secretary Morton has proceeded not only to set aside up to 80 million, but he's actually violated the law by setting 83 million and some additional acres. Absolute violation of the law. Well, now let me give a little background of what's happened here. Secretaries of the Interior, by and large, have been conspicuous enemies of the Alaska interest, possible exceptions being Oscar Chapman and Wally Hickel. But Harold Ickes, Fred Seaton, Stuart Udall, all of them set aside large areas without consultation of the people of Alaska, frequently in violation of their expressed views, and apparently Secretary Morton is repeating that. It's been very difficult to understand how the Alaska delegation could possibly allow this amendment to go through without a struggle. They must have known, because they're now opposed to it, that it was an outrageous thing, because it means that this tremendous area is virtually going to be permanently locked up for all economic development. And that is going to be a staggering blow to the economy of Alaska. It means that within this area, there are tremendously valuable mineral resources, which are now going to be kept out of use. It's going to be a serious blow, not really to the economy of Alaska, but to the national interest. We know that in addition to the shortage of energy, we already have a great shortage of minerals. And we know that under the soil of Alaska, these minerals exist, but we've got to be able to explore for them. Antimony, nickel, copper, manganese, chromium, and so forth. Now, this means that these areas are going to be virtually just wilderness. They're going to be kept alive for the animals, but not for human beings. And you go back to the history of the other Secretaries of the Interior. Harold Ickes arbitrarily set aside the Kenai National Moose Range without any consultation of the people of Alaska, without any hearings of any kind, which seriously interfered with the development of gas and oil there. Fred Seaton, after the Congress had passed, had made a study, was then conducted by my colleague, the late Bob Barker, and decided that those 10 million acres in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge should not be set aside and given to the federal government, but if they were to be set aside at all, they should be turned over to Alaska. And yet Fred Seaton, in the very closing hours of his administration, with a stroke of the pen, set aside these 10 million acres. And Stuart Udall led the fight against the Rampart Dam. Although when he was up for confirmation before the Interior Committee, and I remember very well there, we were questioning him about his policies, and he made the statement that the Republicans, the Eisenhower administration, considered public power a public menace, but that he and the Democrats considered it a public good. And yet, at his first opportunity, he set aside this magnificent development, which would have furnished us with infinite quantities of low-cost hydroelectric power, which in this great present energy shortage, we sorely need. And if that had been allowed to carry on, it would be almost ready now. There's no equivalent in effectiveness and in other advantages to the power generated by running water. It's not depleted like coal and gas. It doesn't pollute the atmosphere. And once harnessed, it runs on forever. There's no additional cost except the amortization cost of the original investment and occasionally a little for a payer. And he did this because he was goaded to it, and he sympathized with the same fanatical conservationists who have fought the pipeline, who are now pushing for this 83 million acre grab on the ground that it would have destroyed the nesting grounds of the ducks and geese on the Yukon Flats. Well, like many of these statements made by these extremists, it doesn't bear examination. There are plenty of other places where those ducks and geese could have nested. But they coined a slogan that if the Rampart Dam were built, there would be one less duck in every California sportsman's bag. Well, I don't consider that an unspeakable calamity. I could live with it, and I think most Alaskans could too. But that was the kind of propaganda they put out. He announced that the moose would be destroyed, which was exactly the same thing they did when they fought the drilling for oil in the Kenai Peninsula. And it's worth going back to that instance to show how false are the charges and the allegations of the conservationists. When this had been set aside back in the 50s, Alaska was virtually bankrupt for the simple reason that our two chief economic crops had been sorely depleted. Our fisheries had been depleted through federal mismanagement. They were being administered by Ira Gabrielson, a conspicuous conservationist, but who couldn't carry out the conservation policies when he was in charge of them as administrator of fisheries. Gold was on its way out because of the low price of gold, and Alaska needed a new economic prop. And we knew that gas and oil underlay the Kenai Peninsula. And so the people of Alaska wanted to drill there. And then the conservationists put up a tremendous uproar of opposition. They said it would destroy the habitat of the moose. Well, those of us who were fighting at that time, who knew this was nonsense, countered by saying that the two-legged species needed a habitat too. And if he didn't have an economy, he didn't have a habitat. Well, Fred Seaton finally allowed half of that area to be open to drilling. And what happened to the moose? They multiplied and spread all over Alaska. And we can take these same charges they make now about the interference with the migration of the caribou, the pipeline, and all these other things equally seriously. Now, in this 83 million acres, which Morton has set aside, as I say, in violation of the legislation which limits him to not more than 80 million acres, are those same duck nesting grounds. And if Rampart is to be revived, and there's a great movement for it, it's been introduced in his program by Dick Gruer. He promises that if he's elected to the Senate, he will push for that. Ted Stevens has already announced he's going to revive Rampart. But if those ducks and nesting ground areas in the Yukon Flats are held out of use, there could be no Rampart Dam. So there's complete indifference to and neglect of the economy of Alaska, the interest of the people of Alaska, all in favor of some fancy damage to wildlife. Now, actually, in this large area to be withdrawn, there are one or two very beautiful areas. There's the Wrangell Mountains area, and as far back as 30 years ago, I visited it and urged it to be made a park. But this program doesn't stop there. 80 million acres is a tremendous area. It's an area larger than any but four states of the Union, larger than any state except Alaska, Texas, Montana, and California. It's larger than the state of Colorado. Now, to say that in that vast area, a mine or a farm or some economic development is going to be a desecration, spoiling of the landscape, is absolutely ridiculous. What these extremists of the Sierra Club, the Friends of the Earth, and the Wilderness Society don't seem to grasp is that conservation and development are not incompatible. We could have both, we need both, and we can have both. But they don't see that. They just want to set everything aside as the wilderness. Now, it is alleged that this is going to be good for tourists, but we know from our own experience that there will be no accommodations built. For 50 years, we've tried to get a hotel in Mount McKinley Park. We haven't got one. And yet, under this program, they want enlargement of Mount McKinley Park substantially. For what? More roving ground for the wolves. Well, I think that's a very short-sighted policy. I think we have virtually enough parks now, virtually enough wildlife refuges. There's no danger that our wildlife will be depleted with proper regulation, and there's no danger that the land will be despoiled. But the economy of Alaska will suffer a very serious, almost a devastating blow if in this tremendous area we're stopped from all economic development. And I intend to do everything I can to call it to the attention of the people of Alaska and see whether it can't be reversed. When I first testified for this, I urged that we have multiple use in this area. Multiple use with adequate protection of the environment. You don't have to have a mine that desecrates the environment. You can have it with a little more control than we've had in the past. And such economic development would be beneficial to all concerned. But as I say, this is the kind of thing that we've been suffering from Secretary of the Interior. But it was always before when we were a territory. And we had a right to assume that when we got statehood, that type of trouble, that type of arbitrary bureaucratic action by a distant federal official would stop. It was stated we'd be masters in our own domain, but apparently that's not the case.
Senator Greening, that was a rather eloquent opening statement that ran about 15 minutes. I wouldn't stop you, but the FCC says we must. Sonny. This is former Senator Ernest Greening, former territorial governor of Alaska. His autobiography, Many Battles, has just been published, and with us this evening, sitting in for the show with the senator, are Dick Grill. He's in real estate. He's also the first Democrat to declare himself as a challenger for Mike Gravel's seat in the Senate. And Joe LaRocca is with us. He's the editor and publisher of Countermedia. Joe has read all of Many Battles and is quite impressed by it. I'll let you tell it yourself in a moment, Joe. I've read half of it. I was about to skim ahead and read the rest of it fast, but you can't do that with this book. I'll ingratiate myself immediately by saying that it's just magnificently well written. Joe, some questions for the senator out of the book and your comments on it.
Well, I've had probably the reason I was able to finish the book, Larry, is that I've had it for quite a while. I picked my copy up in Juneau during the special session started reading it and was pretty much enthralled by what I read. I found the book, both in style and substance, to be first-rate autobiographical writing. But first and foremost, I was most impressed by the earlier sections of the book, which have a great deal to do with Senator Greening's journalistic career prior to his entry into government and politics. And of course, that's my bag, as it is yours. And I had never realized that Senator Greening had had such a leading role in pioneering I suppose we could call ethical journalism, the journalism that existed in the days that he began his newspaper career is far different from the, in certain respects, from the journalism that we know today. And certain aspects of the ethics of journalism in those days were not as they are today. In those days, certain battles for ethical journalism were new battles, and he describes many of those battles in the earlier stages of the book, which was of particular interest to me for that reason. I was interested in noting that on your first day on the job, on a newspaper job, you were working for the Boston American, a Hearst newspaper, and you described an incident on your first day of the job in which you obtained a copy of a speech on which you were assigned to report, and you described how you obtained that speech. It was Judge DeCourcy's speech. He was then the a member of the Massachusetts Supreme Court, and you obtained in the final analysis, when everything else failed, a copy of the speech by representing yourself as an aide to Judge DeCourcy to the persons who had a copy of that speech. And I was kind of interested in the way that you managed to obtain it, and that of course raised a certain question of whether it's whether you think it's ethical or proper for a newsman to go to any lengths to obtain information that he can't obtain perhaps by more conventional means.
Well, if you will read that again, you will find that that's not the case at all. I simply, I never related anything to Judge DeCourcy. I never saw Judge DeCourcy. I simply indicated that I wanted the speech. I never talked to the judge. I think you misread that. It was a perfectly legitimate thing. He had left a copy in the office of the Boston, one Boston paper, and I secured it from that paper. And I didn't tell the newspaper that I was a fellow other journalist, but I wasn't asked whether I was or not.
I think this raises this whole section of the book about your journalism career raises a broad question. You worked for a half dozen or more major publications. From that initial experience in Boston to being editor of the New York Evening Post and being editor of
Tribune.
The Tribune and of the being editor of The Nation. And you sort of mutually quit a half dozen of them or more because of questions of what you were being forced to do. Your integrity was being being pushed. And the publisher or owner or some direct interest on the paper had something they either wanted suppressed or they wanted printed, something in which your the elasticity of your integrity just wasn't enough to handle it, and it was sort of being fired and sort of quitting.
That's true.
You must have been 45 years old, or 40 or 45 when the last of these occurred, Senator. And the question is this. Do you believe that your experiences, what your integrity was tested as an editor or managing editor, was typical of what other men like you were experiencing in other journalistic endeavors? And do you believe it's still the same? Do you believe the commercial side presses in on the newsroom so hard that these questions of integrity are constantly being brought into play?
Well, I think it exists on certain newspapers, but it varies in different cities and different towns. And in some cases, the newspaper editorship, the ownership, exhibits absolute integrity and gets the truth regardless of consequences. But in other cases, they have special access to grind. They keep out news that's unfavorable to advertisers or to certain special interests, and I think it varies from city to city. But by and large, I would say that the standards of journalism are better today than they were in the old days. Now, I don't think any newspaper today is as subject to the pressure of advertisers as the papers I worked in Boston at that time. At that time, an advertiser could call up a newspaper and keep out any story that was displeasing to him, and he could have junk put in the paper that he wanted. Certain stories of strikes in industries, which are advertisers, such as department stores, were never printed. That doesn't exist anymore. And one of the consequences of the disappearance of newspapers, which I think is very tragic, which is due to entirely different causes, I think has raised the standard. I don't think you'll find that sort of thing going on in any of the surviving big papers in the big cities.
You believe then that it's not as tough on a guy in the editorial end of a publication today as it was then?
Yes, I do not. I do not think it's as tough.
Well, do you believe, let me put it this way, whether a person listening is a supporter of yours in a political sense or not, maybe he is, maybe he's not, but your integrity has never been questioned by anyone I've ever heard from. Are we short of people in journalism today with that kind of integrity?
I don't think we're short of people in journalism. I think we're short of people in politics and in other fields. I think we're short altogether. I think there's been a marked deterioration in ethical standards. Has been demonstrated what happened in Washington and has been revealed by Watergate. The kind of betrayal of integrity and decency and honesty is almost unprecedented in its degree and in its versatility and its widespread character. And most of us would not have believed that that could possibly happen a few years ago. But I think it's exceptional. I don't think it'll happen again. And I think that when the smoke clears away from Watergate, if Congress takes the proper drastic action, I don't think it'll happen again for a while, anyhow.
Then you would say that when Spiro Agnew pointed the finger, or Richard Nixon pointed the finger at the press, that it wasn't the press that was lacking in integrity, that it was indeed the finger pointers?
They were lacking in integrity. They were completely false in their statements. Spiro Agnew kept on denying that he'd committed any offenses. He said they were damn lies. All the time, he'd been guilty of multiple offenses of an unprecedented character. He'd taken bribes while holding three very important executive positions, first as executive of Baltimore County, then as governor of Maryland, and then as vice president of the United States. And the most shocking aspect of the Agnew episode is that he got off with a slap on the wrist. The poor fellow who steals $5 worth of groceries goes to jail. Agnew, who committed these multiple crimes, in addition to violating the income tax reports again and again and again, got off with a fine, nominal fine. And I think that was a shocking example of the kind of laxity and indifference to high standards which characterized this administration and characterized it still.
Joe or Dick, do you have any questions from the early part of the book? I have several. You've always been looked at as being somewhat of a visionary, most recently in your role as an Alaska senator and your position on Vietnam. But long before that, you had things you crusaded for that subsequently came to pass. And of course, a leading one was birth control.
Yeah.
Well, through the first part of the book, you favored and pointed out all the points at which you favored birth control, Senator. And to me, you kept coming off as being almost anti-Catholic. And time again, I can see you at odds with the Catholic Church and the Catholic hierarchy. Are you?
Absolutely not. I think that the Catholic Church, as Dr. John Rock, a noted Catholic gynecologist who's a strong advocate of birth control, says, he had no doubt, whatever, that the church would come around, as it did in the case of Galileo. Of course, Galileo was treated as a heretic because he'd said that the sun moves around the earth, not the earth around the sun. And Dr. Rock said the only doubt he had was to the speed with which the Catholic Church would come to see the light. And in answer to my question, he said, well, it took 300 years. Now, I haven't any question that within the church today, there are bishops and others who realize that we've got to have birth control. We can't have population increase. As a matter of fact, they favor birth control, but by a particular method called the rhythm method, which just doesn't work. So they're not opposed to the principle, but they're opposed to the method. And I'm not anti-Catholic. In fact, I've fought for the Catholic Church many times against bigots who've attacked it. But I think this is a case where they're just wrong. And I think time will show it.
Just one comment, Larry. I think that's interesting that you should have detected what you thought was an anti-Catholic bias. I was reared as a Catholic, and I never detected it. And one would think that I would be more sensitive to that, but I never crossed my mind.
But Larry's from Ohio.
That accounts for it.
Well, I raise it for a complex reason, and maybe I won't state the question very well. People have over the years, Senator, said that you have communist leanings, or that you're too liberal, or that you're this, or that you're that, and you have been maligned from time to time, going back to your journalistic career, and you've had to defend yourself with suits which you have won. But I can't put my finger on what you are, other than, and again, I'll ingratiate myself, other than being an exceedingly intelligent man who can't, I'm hasty to label someone, but I cannot label you, because in my question about whether you might be anti-Catholic, you can oppose something like the abortion stance of the Catholic Church, but go on as you illustrate in other anecdotes in the book, and be supportive of the Catholic Church. You can do this with everything. You can pick out the thing you don't like. You can be supportive of conservation. You could be talking with Harold Ickes about not wanting the Russian River ravaged, but you can be slapping the hand today of Interior Secretary Morton for locking up land that shouldn't be. You are so consistently inconsistent that you're difficult to label. Can you label yourself?
I would say that this is a mistaken diagnosis on your part. I'm not consistently inconsistent. I think in the case of Rogers Morton, he's just following the arbitrary actions of future Secretaries of the Interior who have sought to impose their will and their ideas on the people of Alaska. I believe in the voice of popular opinion. I believe that the people of Alaska should be the final arbiters of their destiny. And when a distant bureaucrat, whether his name be Harold Ickes or Stuart Udall or Fred Seaton or Morton, imposes these ideas which are definitely contrary to the wish and desire of the people of Alaska, that's a ground for protest.
You used to work for Harold Ickes, and although you didn't say so in the book, you didn't like him very much, did you?
Before he came to the Interior Department, I was tremendously thrilled with the idea of this man, who, as we believed at the time, had fought all his life for unpopular but losing and worthwhile causes in the West. And it was only when I discovered, after he'd come to the department, that he was completely untrustworthy, that he was a two-timer, that I was disillusioned. And I think I cite enough examples, specifically stating the facts, to demonstrate that I was right in this. He chose to be known as Honest Harold. As a newspaper man, I long discovered that when a man in public life wanted to be known as Honest John or Honest Dan or Honest something else, better look out for him. He's probably the guy who's been dipping into the Sunday school till. And Honest Harold was no exception.
Has there ever been an Interior Secretary, including inclusive of Ickes and since, that you thought did a good job?
Absolutely. Wally Hickel did a superb job. He did such a good job that he was fired by Nixon. Oscar Chapman, who succeeded Ickes, did an excellent job. Those were two outstanding Secretaries of the Interior.
But maybe not any others.
Well, those were within my experience, yes. But let's just consider the actions. This is not a matter of opinion. You think that when Fred Seaton, in the closing hours of his administration, after we'd had extensive hearings on the Arctic Wildlife Range, heard all kinds of testimony, and the committee which heard them recommended that no action be taken, and then he arbitrarily set this 10 million acres aside with a stroke of the pen, do you think that is not subject to legitimate criticism? I do.
Okay, now you said that I had badly misinterpreted you by saying that you are consistently inconsistent, but I asked you at that point if you could describe Ernest Greening yourself, if you could, you know, there's a can of beans over here, and it sort of helps if it's Blue Lake green beans. That gives you a little clear idea. In a capsule, label yourself, Senator.
Well, I think that we have to have a humanistic approach, and I think that the welfare of the people should be supreme. I think the best illustration of what I mean is what this nation represented from the time of its birth. Government by consent of the governed, a government of laws and not of men, equal justice for all. Those are the things I believe in. And I have tried to fight injustice and discrimination, as you know, all my life. One reason I have fought the discrimination against people of color. I fought the discrimination against the Eskimos and Indians here in Alaska. When I first came to Alaska, I didn't discover this immediately. I found that natives were being excluded from restaurants and other places, and I sought to remedy that and finally got legislation which outlawed that. And this is the kind of thing we've also fought for on the national scale. It was only accomplished in the late 1960s with the Equal Rights Act, which barred the signs white and colored. Now, I think the cruelty of those previous injustices is so obvious that I don't think there's much room for argument. I think one of our worst national sins is racial prejudice. And I think we ought to try to eliminate it, and certainly to limit it by legislation wherever we can. Now, I don't think there's anything strange.